stayed at Karen's house. I forgot the girl's name, but I remember looking at her dress through the mirror on the wall in Karen's room as the girl lay sleeping. That was very nice of Karen to let us stay there. Meg and I loved when bands stayed at our house as well. On the road, I always want to go through people's books and things, but I never have the courage to be that nosy and intrusive. Karen's place was like that. Nick Zinner. I mean, we didn't know them, but the show was really fun. I remember there was an English person in the crowd that night. It was mostly our friends, and then this one English guy. Afterwards, he said, "You guys should really come over to England." We were like, "What the fuck, are you serious? That's crazy. That's the craziest thing you could ever say." Brian Chase. I'll tell you what I remember about that first show. I remember that before I knew it, it was over. Chapter 28. British people are crazy. Albert Hammond Jr. I have to tell the truth. Fab punched a mailbox. Someone was making fun of Adam Green, and he went to protect him.
Kelly Kiley. I've never known a band to get security so quickly. Laura Young. The first time I ever saw the Strokes, in the middle of the show, Julian started staring off into the distance. Like, totally dead-eye staring. Then you just see him jump off stage into the crowd, and there was a kerfuffle. He was getting into a fight. Very quickly, one of the bouncers came in and broke it up, but I was like, "Oh my God, this is so awesome. This is my first Stroke show, and Julian's getting into a fight." They had this reputation in the press of being bad boys. Drinking a lot, getting into trouble. That was their whole persona. Cool New York, don't give a fuck type of dudes. So I was like, "Holy shit, I can't believe I'm seeing this." We hung out after the show, and I remember overhearing Julian talking to some random dudes, and he said, "He was giving me the eye." That was his explanation as to why he jumped into the crowd. It wasn't that he threw something at me or that he spat at me. It was, he was looking at me funny.
Albert Hammond Jr. Everyone thought we were fighters. I couldn't care less about fighting. I want to fight off women, not men. Adam Green. We were in Glasgow, and some guys decided that they didn't like my Robin Hood outfit. Fabrizio Moretti. We were waiting for chicken tikka masala late at night. Or chicken korma. I can't remember what it was. A chicken dish that was delicious when everything else is closed and you are so hungry and so wasted. Some man started to make fun of Adam's outfit in that Glaswegian drawl where you barely understand what he's saying but you get the intonation. So I said something about how he should go fuck himself. Adam Green. Fab was like, "Fuck you. I like his Robin Hood outfit." Fabrizio Moretti. Julian was a little more sober and probably more realistic, and he was like, "What?" And he grabbed me and pulled me outside. Albert Hammond Jr. Julian was like, "Come on, dude, this guy is big. Let's get out of here. There's no point in fighting. British people are crazy." Adam Green. Fab was just so angry. He just punched a mailbox and broke his hand. And that's how they got Matt Romano. Matt Romano. It was a big moment for me. That was essentially the beginning of my adult life. I was outside cutting the grass when Ryan called. My mom answered. She said, "Ryan, he's outside cutting the grass. Can I tell him to call you back?" And he was like, "Could you go get him? It's kind of important and I'm calling long distance." I guess she hears me talking and I ask, "Mom, I have a passport, right?" That was it.
Kelly Kiley. During that second UK tour, after the EP had come out, there was lunacy. They played Oxford and Kate Moss was there. It was, "Of course she's going to be there. This is the new thing, so she's going to get in on it as early as possible." Kim Taylor Bennett. I remember Albert being quite thrilled that Kate Moss was there.
Russell Warby. I don't think that when Kate first met the Strokes that she thought they were especially nice to her. They were a bit like, you know, "Hi," being very cool about it. I'm sure she would have liked them to be very excited.
Kelly Kiley. I loved how Julian would not give a shit about any of the celebs. He just didn't care. You'd think he'd be the one, but that was Nick, even quite early on. Later, after Nick met Amanda de Cadenet, they'd say, "We've seen these Hermes cuffs. Can you get them for us?" Julian likes nice things, but I don't think he wanted to be as ostentatious. Julian has always been the most reserved, the most against all of the adulation, the celeb stuff, and just more conservative or down to earth. Julian is a control freak, but he was the most real.
Jim Merlis. One day Nick says to me, "I have this new girlfriend. She's English. She's older." And I was like, "Who is she?" And he's like, "You don't know her. Her name's Amanda de Cadenet." And I was like, "No, I do know her. I used to be Courtney Love's publicist, remember? I totally know Amanda." Mark Spitz. She was John Taylor's wife, and she was like seen stumbling around with Courtney Love when Courtney was trying to be a movie star.
Amanda de Cadenet. I moved to L.A. in like 95 or 96. I had a little kid. She was one. I was like the only teenager I knew that had a kid. It was so crazy. And I was really famous in the UK, and I really hated it, and I just needed to be an anonymous person and figure out what the hell I wanted to do. I was so young. We live many lives, right? I had already lived like 5 lives by the age of 30.
Thomas Honorato. Coming to America had erased her past, because no one knows that she was a VJ on The Word in the 90s. You could find clips of her on YouTube interviewing people like Flavor Flav.
Amanda de Cadenet. It was a live late-night music show where, like, Nirvana and the Smashing Pumpkins and the Chili Peppers played for the first time on television in the UK. I interviewed all those people. And then Britpop was just exploding, so we had Oasis and Blur and the Happy Mondays. It was that whole time of just insanity. Music was my culture, and those were my friends, and I had grown up in that. I had become like a household name very young. I had that experience. And then my first husband was in Duran Duran.
James Endicott. I remember talking to Nick about her. He's like, "You know Amanda de Cadenet?" And I'm like, "Yeah, she's really well known in the UK. She's got quite a bad rap over here. People don't like her. She has a reputation as a wild party child that was a little bit off the rails, that wasn't very good at TV presenting, that was very, very young when she married the guy from Duran Duran. Just a rich kid. Nick had no idea, and why should he?" Jim Merlis. Nick has a thing for older blonde women. Before Amanda, he was dating Pearl Lowe, who was married to one of the guys in the British band Supergrass. James Endicott. That world, the Kate Mossy, Pearl Lowy world, once that world found out about you, it's like, phew.
Kelly Kiley. Pearl had a reputation, and Nick was young, but he was totally into it. She used to turn up at the hotel, and they'd disappear together. That went on for quite a while until Amanda. I remember later Amanda was at the NME Awards and Pearl was there. She was saying to me, "I can't believe Amanda stole my man. She's supposed to be one of my best friends."
Nick Valenci. The previous time we'd been in England, we went to these indie nights at clubs in London. We were in the loudest club in the world, and there was this guy sitting in the corner of the club, surrounded by kind of slutty-looking girls. And he was playing the acoustic guitar in this super loud club. He wanted to talk to me, show me songs he had written, telling me he's starting a band. He was with this Italian girl, and the whole thing felt like there was sexual undertones. They were obviously together, but there was kind of insinuations of, "Well, maybe we'll all get together tonight," that kind of thing. He wanted to come back to my hotel with me, and I was like, "No, man, I'm sorry, I have to go." I remember leaving thinking, that guy was fucking crazy. I think the club was called Trash.
Jenny Penny. Trash was like the Misshapes of London.
Paul Banks. We went all the time. Because we were a band from New York, we could get into those clubs and jump the line.
April Long. That party was a petri dish for all kinds of, you know, London ne'er-do-wells. It was also a little bit less indie, a little bit more dancey, which was super fun because, again, at that time, there had been no dancey-dancey for quite a while.
Caleb Folliwell. Trash was fucking amazing. We would walk in with sunglasses on and people are just handing you stuff and you're just putting it in your mouth. It was like the movies, like John Travolta walking into a bar. We would walk in the bar and people would just be handing you drinks, drugs. Nick Valenci. So then we went to England to do our second tour, and Jeff Travis from Rough Trade said, I have this great band, they're called the Libertines, and they're going to open for you. We get to the venue, the first gig of the tour, and who is the guy who's fucking singing in this band but the crazy guy with the acoustic guitar from the night at that club? It was Pete Doherty. He remembered me very clearly. He knew who I was the first time I met him. Carl Barrett. They were on Rough Trade in England, and that was a big thing. And we had been to see a gig in Liverpool. We jumped the train. Their EP had just come out, and we stole it from the shop in the station, and we were looking at the lyrics on the way up. We were like, these motherfuckers from America. We wear those clothes. We do this. Albert Hammond Jr. I remember meeting Pete Doherty and Carl in Liverpool. They gave me acid and tried to get on our bus. Then 6 months later, they had formed a band and were opening for us. Nick Valenci. I could see that Pete kind of looked like Julian, and I could see how they dressed like us. I didn't think their music really sounded like us, though. We're musically very precise. We have very tight arrangements, and they're very loose. Pete and Carl certainly looked not that different from us. Adam Green. The funniest thing is that they were all in suits, and I remember thinking like, wow, they're already wearing these fucking suits. They're trying to be like the Strokes. That had already seeped in. Carl Barat. I think the boys were kind enough to lend us some money after the show. We went for some chips and then departed company. I think it was Nick who pulled out a fan of notes, and I pointed out which ones I'd like. He'd possibly not seen Pounds much before. And maybe we took a little bit advantage of that.
Jeanette Lee. Julian really did not take to Peter. His response was, who is that guy?
Julian Casablancas. I mean, we played shows with them, I think, somewhere. Leeds, or I can't remember where. I never really broed out with those guys.
Jeanette Lee. Peter is trying to pick everybody's pocket, trying to take everybody's credit cards when they are not looking. Also, the Libertines had a very open attitude toward drugs as well. I mean, they didn't bother to try to conceal it.
Jeff Travis. Peter wouldn't hide anything from the chief constable.
Jeanette Lee. I asked Pete Doherty once. We were at Top of the Pops Studios, and I asked him, what was the first band you ever heard or you ever saw that made you want to be in a band? And he said, The Strokes. I nearly fell off my chair because The Strokes seemed like about 6 weeks old to me. Most people would say something from the 60s, but he said The Strokes.
Jeff Travis. We know that The Strokes had a big effect on the Libertines, in the sense that when they heard it, they realized they had to up their game, and they probably changed their sound. And of course, we put them on with The Strokes deliberately, to galvanize them. Mark Ronson. I remember asking someone what the Libertines were, and they said they were like the British version of The Strokes. And I remember being like, well, I have The Strokes, I don't really need the British version. I know English kids who are 7 years younger, who that band was so seminal that they'd cry if Can't Stand Me Now comes on at a certain point in the evening. It didn't grab me. And like I said, if this is the British Strokes, well, we have the Strokes. I wasn't super interested in it. Adam Green. When we got to Sweden, it was the same thing with the Hives. I was like, really? This is in Sweden. It was hilarious. When we got to Sweden, they were like, oh, well, we're going to play a show with the Swedish Strokes. The Hives are really good, but they're not the Swedish Strokes. Ryan Gentles. The album came out that July in Australia, and a few months later in the UK. Connor Oberst. That summer, the summer of 2001, was really the summer of the Strokes over there. We were touring England, and that's where I first saw someone walking around with that original t-shirt. I thought, the Strokes. Does that mean, like, have a stroke? Or a pool stroke? It kind of looked like the Storks, if you looked at it wrong. The record wasn't out in America yet, but in every club we were playing, they'd be playing it as we walked in the door. Ryan Gentles. The UK version had New York City Cops on it. Connor Oberst. My drummer Matt was singing that song all the time when we were on tour in Europe. We got stopped with drugs going from Christiania, an anarchist community in Copenhagen, into Sweden. Only time I've ever been strip-searched in my life. There's an 80-year-old Swedish officer spreading my cheeks looking for stuff. He was nice. Anyway, after that, Matt switched his singing to Swedish border cops. Swedish border cops. They took our hash. Connor McNicholas. The Strokes did this brilliant thing of giving everybody permission to self-consciously be a band.
Jeanette Lee. They touched the same spot in me as seeing the Sex Pistols and the Clash had. Not because they sounded like them, but there was something about the energy.
Mark Ronson. I was obsessed with that record. Their song Someday starts with that kick and snare before the song comes in. I took that and chopped it up for Rhymefest's first album. I'd see Albert out. We'd all be fucked up, and I'd be like, would you come play guitar on this song if we redid it? He'd called me one night and said, I got your message, yeah. Is this the part you want? He put down the phone and picks up a guitar, and I hear him playing the part. I played that recording for everyone. I played it for my girlfriend. How cool is that? I mean, I was obsessed. There was a coffee place on 2nd and A that I used to go to, and I saw Nick and his massive dog. I'd be like, oh shit, that's Nick. I'm like, it's so weird that I'm acting like a giddy schoolgirl. It even feeds into the stuff I did with Amy Winehouse, because when we were doing the demos for Back to Black, when Amy first came to New York, she would play me the songs she'd written on the guitar. Then she'd leave me overnight to experiment with different arrangement ideas until I had something. I remember her coming to the studio as I was putting the Verse to Rehab together. I was like, let me try this kind of beat. And she was like, are you trying to make me sound like the Bloody Libertines? If I had been only in my own hip-hop world, it wouldn't have occurred to me to make some of those records. I think that's part of the reason that Amy's record was so massively received by the NME and those indie places. I mean, partly it's because she's such a firebrand and looked like such an outcast, rebel, awesome, iconic figure. But it's also that they were all guitar-based records. Wake Up Alone? There hadn't been anything like that with guitars in it and soul music for 20 years. And that's my debt to New York. Jeff Travis. The Strokes' arrival was a bomb in the middle of a plastic pool. Connor McNicholas. Suddenly, it was okay to be a star. Chapter 29. All Eyes on NYC.
Justine D. Nothing was happening, and then everything happened. Alex Wagner. Things were coalescing around New York culturally in a way that they hadn't in a long time. There was this momentum. And maybe it didn't yet feel like it mattered on a national level, although, of course, ultimately it would. But if you were into the downtown rock scene, it was an incredibly fruitful moment. There was the feeling that every night there was some awesome thing that was going to happen.
Jim Merlis. I remember going back to the office after that first early meeting with the Strokes, and it was like, hey, you young guys in the office, if there's anything else like this out there, please let me know. We never did that. We never called meetings. Adam Green. Rough Trade came to New York to sign us.
Kim Yao Dawson. Basically, after the Strokes got signed to Rough Trade, they told Rough Trade they wanted them to sign us, too, and they did. Jeff Travis came to see us play at Sidewalk.
Adam Green. They took me to pick a bagel. I always hear those stories about how you get signed and you make them take you out to Nobu and shit. Rough Trade took me to pick a bagel. We signed for $1,000. After that, everybody got signed.
Allison Mosshart. The Kills' stipulations for signing with Rough Trade in America, they were just opening an office there, was that they had to put their office in the Chelsea Hotel, in room 103. And they did it. It was fucking awesome because their office was next to my room. So I would just go over there and see how everything was going, then go back to bed. It was great. Eleanor Friedberger. We had a 5-record deal with Rough Trade, and we got a bigger advance each time. We had all this creative freedom. It was really incredible. And Jeff Travis, you couldn't dream of a better cheerleader. It wasn't until much later when we made the record with our grandmother that they were like, what the fuck are you guys doing?
Nick Valenci. You can't underestimate how important it is for an American band to get across the Atlantic. Connor McNicholas. It was immediately like, they're brilliant. What else have you got? Anything? It was like the Beatles being exposed to all of this amazing blues and early rock and roll in Liverpool. Because that's where all the American soldiers were coming through on the ships, and so the record stores happened to have these tracks. It was the same thing. With all these kids stuck over here, desperate for all the cool stuff that was coming out of America. Except we had email. Mark Ronson. Americans take it for granted because they have it. If you live in New York, you can go out at any time and see a good indie band. If you live in New Orleans, you can go out and see jazz anytime you want. Blues in Chicago, whatever it is. In England, when a new record comes out, you're the guy who works in a record shop that's literally just got this box of 145s from the States in 1962 and is about to open them up. It's not made in England, so you get so excited, and you take out the records and say, this is incredible. Daniel Kessler. It was funny. We couldn't get arrested to save our lives 6 months before the Strokes took off. Then, all of a sudden, it was lunacy. That's the game. I think sometimes about The Wire. In this business, it's a hustle. Luke Jenner. I was really excited because I could go on Avenue A to this magazine store and buy copies of NME and be like, dude, this is all happening around me, and eventually they're gonna find me. Daniel Kessler. It was a fever. British journalists needed story angles on a weekly basis, and fortunately, there were a lot of good bands here. Mark Ronson. It became almost like the 60s again. It really made the NME a super-relevant New York publication again. That's where we have to go to read about our things. Dean Wareham. They had all these weeklies, like Melody Maker and NME, and they were geared toward teenagers who want to read about bands every week. I mean, these are national magazines that are available at every train station all over England. Anthony Rossomando. Everybody over there is so goddamn passionate about music. Dean Wareham. Whereas here, we had these little fanzines that you could find at these certain select stores if you sought them out. And of course radio, we had college radio. But they had John Peel. Whatever he was playing, everyone was listening to. Anthony Rossomando. In England, America is a much bigger deal than it is at home. Adam Green. I remember when Kimya and I went to England to play with the Strokes. We arrived and the Strokes were playing Top of the Pops that night. So we go to the television studio. We started walking around and everyone was saying, oh, you guys are the Moldy Peaches. We just read about you in NME. We were blown away. We didn't know anything about England. And we'd obviously never experienced anything like that before. People were stopping us on the street and inviting us into their houses. We basically went from New York to England and just never worked another job again. Steve Schiltz. It's important to remember that this was before Friendster, MySpace, Facebook, Twitter. At that time, there were probably only like 2 or 3 pictures of the Strokes. Even though I was their friend, that's how fucking cool it was. How convincing it was to see them in a magazine looking like the coolest band you ever saw in your life. I believed it so much that I thought I would never be friends with them again. They were mysterious. They were gone. Sam Fogarino. We went over to the UK, before we were signed, before we even had management, to do a little tour and record a Peel session, which was a big deal. The Strokes had just been there, and it was a frenzy, it was a craze. The next thing you know, as a result of that trip, there was this issue of NME. The cover just said, "We Heart New York." Rob Sheffield. That cover is legendary. They asked the Strokes about 70s New York, like they asked about CBGBs. And I remember they're like, "What? CBGB sucks. Don't go there. We wouldn't play there." Jim Merlis. That was Nick. He's very blunt. I was like, "That's the funniest thing I've ever heard." And he was like, "I wasn't trying to be funny." And I said, "I know. That's why it's even funnier." Sam Fogarino. The Strokes were at the top of the list, but there was Interpol in there with no record deal. We just had this single out. Being the older guy, I said, "Oh, I remember when NME did We Love Seattle." It was just a decade prior, you know? Something was shifting. I knew it was just a matter of time. Jason Gordon. And that was the thing. It wasn't about one band igniting all of this. It was this energy that surrounded all these bands. Maybe not between the actual band members, but between the people that would see all these separate bands. It used to be, punks don't go to dance shows. Dance kids don't go to rock shows. Now suddenly it was, "I am a punk, and I'm going to go dancing at the Rapture show tonight." Luke Jenner. People just thought of us as a disco Strokes. They were like, "We need to sign a band like the Strokes, and you're it." And we were like, "Cool. Here's my bank account number." Steve Schiltz. The Strokes happened, and you realized, "Oh, wait. These guys are like 21 years old. Their manager is 22, and they're the coolest thing happening, and they're friends of ours." You start thinking, "Wow, maybe you don't have to listen to this bullshit from people that say they know everything about the music industry. Maybe we can do this too." Matt Romano. So, we'd been on this insane European tour after the record came out in the UK. We were supposed to go to Japan and Australia next, but first we went to the West Coast and did a string of shows. San Diego, San Francisco, LA, Vancouver. This was my first trip to LA. We were staying at the Hollywood Roosevelt on Hollywood Boulevard. Very cool, very old Hollywood. Spike Jones came down to say hi. We were having a good time. That little West Coast run ended, and after that we were supposed to go to Japan, but everybody's just fucking exhausted, fried. So we decided to stop in Hawaii on the way for a little vacation. There we are on the west coast of Oahu. Everybody is just coming down off the road and feeling good. We cancel the Japan trip. We come home, and then September 11th happened. Chapter 30. September 11th, 2001. Jesse Malin. As people will tell you, it was one of the most beautiful days in New York, weather-wise. Albert Hammond Jr. I was in my apartment with Julian, 19th and 2nd Avenue. We saw the buildings fall from our window. Julian Casablancas. We didn't have any view except for the Twin Towers. That was the only thing you could see.
Karen O. Nick and I hung out the night before, and I just crashed in his room. He went to work early that morning. When I woke up, around 10 or 11, everyone was watching it on the television in the loft.
Paul Banks. I was on Grand and Ludlow, where I lived. Sam Fogarino. I was in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. I watched them fall from my roof. Albert Hammond Jr. It was weird to see it from far away because it started to fall, but there was a delay with the sound. You could almost still see it standing, even though you knew it was falling, and all of a sudden it wasn't there anymore. It looked so unreal. You're in such shock that you don't even realize you're in shock. You were like, it fucking fell. The whole fucking thing fell. Paul Banks. I had a job then. At that point, I was doing data entry for Scholastic News. This is after I bailed on doing a real career. I was just doing shit work. I woke up to 10-10 wins every day. And some chick phoned in and said a plane crashed into the Twin Towers. I thought, ah, cool, I'll go see that. Because I'm thinking it has to be a Cessna. Some moron in a Cessna just crashed into the Twin Towers. I walk down and see Armageddon happening.
Karen O. I just kind of wandered the streets. I don't even remember how I got back to the East Village, but there was literally this toxic haze, like toxic smog that was just sitting over all of downtown. On Avenue A, you couldn't see 5 feet in front of you.
Moby. It's my birthday, September 11th. That morning, of course, I was drunk from the night before, and the phone started ringing at 8-something. I remember thinking, who would call me at this ungodly hour on my birthday? It kept ringing and kept ringing, and I was like, oh, something bad must have happened. At that point, I heard the second plane hit the tower. I ran up on my roof. I was 1.5 miles away from the Twin Towers. The only time I'd ever experienced anything like that was watching a Jerry Bruckheimer movie. That's exactly what it looked like. It looked like cinematic CGI. Paul Banks. You know how in movies like King Kong, women put their hands over their mouths and run the other way? I saw that for real. That's not just a film trope. That's an animal thing that humans do. A reflex. Moby. It's this thing where 99.999% of what we experience is stuff we've already experienced. You touch a teacup, and in some archetypal, compartmentalized level, it reminds you of every other teacup you've touched. The weight, temperature, everything about it. Rarely do we experience anything genuinely new. I looked up and saw these huge flames billowing out of the Twin Towers, and my brain couldn't process it. Because I couldn't figure out what was happening. There was this lapse of, I don't know what I'm experiencing. And all the roofs of all the buildings around me were covered with people screaming and pointing. Tunde Edebimpe. I was asleep, and I got a phone call from my friend Zach. He just said, wake up. Dude, what the fuck? Get up, get up. Dude, a plane just flew into the World Trade Center. And I said, keep in mind that my friends and I had a long history of pranking the shit out of each other, fuck you, and hung up the phone. The phone rings again. He's like, no, dude, seriously, go to your roof. Go to your roof. I went upstairs, and it was right after Tower 1 had been hit. I stood there for a while and ran downstairs, banging on Dave's door. Albert Hammond Jr. Julian's girlfriend, Colleen, wanted to go visit someone at a hospital. We went, and it was like paranoia on the streets. Someone's cell phone wouldn't stop ringing, and they couldn't stop it, and everyone started to run away from them because they thought it was a bomb. So we just started running too. Julian Casablancas. It was just like mayhem. Mayhem. Chaos. I don't love talking about it, I guess.
Karen O. Everyone was really forlorn and depressed. I remember going to Odessa, and it was really crowded, and everyone was just drinking themselves into a stupor. It was palpable. Collective grief.
Tunde Edebimpe. We all walk down onto Grand Street in Williamsburg. We all stop there, and we're just staring at it when this guy walked by us. If this were a movie, that guy would be foreshadowing the next 15 years. We're all staring at this building, freaked out, just really, really freaked out, wondering what's happening, and this guy stops next to us. He's got a briefcase and a tie. He's a little bit older than us, and he's like, oh my God, a lot of clients of mine were in that building. I probably just lost a lot of clients. We all looked at him, and before we realized what was happening, we were holding Dave back because he was about to beat the shit out of this guy. We were all thinking, like, what the fuck is this dude even doing here?
Alex Wagner. I was editor-in-chief of Tokyon Magazine at the time, and the offices were downtown, on the Lower East Side, on Clinton between Rivington and Delancey. I walked into the office that morning, and we just heard people start screaming. Half an hour later, people started walking up the street covered in ash, and they started flying fighter jets over Manhattan. You heard the sound of an airplane at low altitude, and it was totally terrifying. You didn't know whether they were going to start flying planes into Manhattan. It was this feeling, something that is super foreign to Americans, which is you are completely unprotected and totally alone.
John Heilman. I remember in that first week or so, British friends of mine saying, what about the Blitz? We got bombed for years. The city got bombed by the Nazis for years. Get over it. And I remember saying to them, come on, guys. This has never happened here before. Give us a little bit of time. Connor Oberst. I think I successfully avoided flying for 6 months. I was scared. Paul Banks. I volunteered that whole day. My roommate Sebastian and I get on these MTA buses and we drive across the West Side Highway. We take off our t-shirts so they can be used as tourniquets for all these people we're going to rescue. They're teaching us CPR. You know, this was official. And we're just standing around. I wound up kind of saying to some fire marshal guy, I was like, are we going to go in? Are we going to do anything? And he said, quote, we're waiting for that building to come down. So I can vouch for the fact that they knew ahead of time that Building 7 was going to fall. Whether there was a conspiracy or not, I don't know. But I didn't do shit. I just stood around on the West Side Highway with my shirt off, with the volunteer group all fucking day, until sundown. But the one thing that I took away as being really, really memorable was seeing a bus full of firefighters going to the site. Fast forward a couple of hours. It's dark, and the bus comes back with all the lights on inside, showing the firefighters completely covered in ash. I can see their faces, and the look was deep dejection. That shit was heavy. Nick Offer. I was in Brooklyn. We watched it on the roof, and then we walked down to where you could see Manhattan from the water. It was all, you know, Hasidic Jews and Puerto Rican kids rolling blunts, and everyone all just in it together. I remember someone saying, this is like Pearl Harbor. Then we went to McCarran Park and hung out on the grass. And that night we went to Union Pool. And there was nobody there, so we came back to our house and got really high and played house music. And danced. It was the Prince 1999 kind of thing, you know? The world's gonna end. So let's fucking party. Jesse Mallon. We were just out of our minds. I didn't know what to do. I just walked down the street, and the streets were kind of dead at that hour. I bumped into Patricia Field, and I started talking to her. Nobody's phones are working. I just ended up in a bar in the afternoon. I ended up at Niagara. I walked in there, and just got behind the bar, and I just started tending bar to everybody. Nick Valenci. That evening, that night, after shit had kind of died down, we all met up. I remember we were all talking on the phone. What are we going to do? What are we doing? Let's go to the studio, to the rehearsal room. Albert Hammond Jr. We rehearsed that night. Nick Valenci. We drank and played and worked on new music, and also discussed what we were going to do with this New York City cops debacle. There was just so much going on. All these cops and firefighters who had just died? We didn't want to be insensitive. Ryan Gentles. September 11 was actually the release date of Is This It on vinyl, which is why it still has the track New York City Cops on it. Albert Hammond Jr. Our album was coming out September 24th. Suddenly people were talking about taking New York City Cops off the record. Matt Romano. That was a bummer. Albert Hammond Jr. We were like, no, no, no. Julian was like, it's just a song. I don't care. It has nothing to do with... At a time like that, though, people get hysterical. Dave Gottlieb. I remember an email coming in from somebody who worked with retail, and he had written this paragraph about how he had put the Strokes record on, and it got to New York City cops, and it made him angry because he was looking out of his window and seeing the ashes of the Twin Towers, and this song made him take the CD out and throw it away.
Kimya Dawson. We ended up leaving on the U.S. tour not even 2 weeks later. Everybody asked, are you going to cancel your tour? We said, we can't cancel our tour. People need this right now.
Vito Roccaforte. The Rapture had a tour booked, and we left a week afterward. It was really interesting because we got to see the rest of the country's take on 9/11. I remember being in Cleveland, and the front page of their free paper was, Are We Next? People really cared, and genuinely worried, but you just saw how distorted things got so quickly. Like from what we saw and experienced to what people were imagining. That front page of the paper wasn't uncommon. There was a lot of fear. There was shit like Mexican people getting beat up in the Midwest because people thought they were Arabs.
Alex Wagner. I remember just after 9/11, driving down to the ICA in Philadelphia, and people were still really freaked out. I was in the car with one of my friends from India, and some jaywalker looked at us through the window and just started yelling at us, assuming we were Muslim because we were brown.
Vito Roccaforte. And the police. Really intense police scene. And weird graffiti on overpasses and stuff. People were really angry. I was really angry. I remember being in the Midwest, and we got pulled over a lot on that tour because we're in a white van with New York plates. Everybody was on such high alert. Angus Andrew. We went on tour, and our first show was in D.C. 2 days after 9/11, so we drove past the Pentagon. It was such a crazy time to be on the road in a brown beat-up van with New York plates, because the whole country was in shock. We were traveling around as sort of spokespeople for what happened. Like everywhere we ended up, that was what we talked about.
Regina Spektor. You got to see how much New York means to the entire world.
Mark Maron. After 9/11, people started to come to gawk at the fucking smoking rubbish. I remember getting mad about that. It became a national wound that represented something to people who were nationalistic. I'm not saying they're bad, but the idea was they were coming to support us, and it didn't actually feel like that. I understand that it's a national wound, and you need to come and see it, but we were just trying to get on with our lives, and it seemed a little morbid to come visit that thing before they even cleaned it up. It was a whole city with PTSD trying to function. That melting metal smell. It went on for months. It was gnarly, dude. Tunde Erebimpe. Giuliani had been so vilified, everyone was so like, fuck this guy, he's an evil motherfucker. Then, the day after 9/11, we start to call Manhattan Flaghattan, because there were American flags everywhere. Instantly, Giuliani is a hero. He's standing with W, hanging out, smiling. Dean Wareham. All of a sudden, Rudy Giuliani went from someone everyone hated to someone everyone loved. Carl Swanson. People were scared of New York, and 9/11 totally changed that. We now had America's mayor, and there was this idea that you were cheering on the city. Vito Roccaforte. There were tanks across Houston. It was crazy for a long time. Tunde Erebimpe. Basically, we were like, this is end times.
Alex Wagner. There was this sense of, there is no place for me to hide. Like, nothing matters and everything is temporary. We were walking around a gravesite, breathing in the dust of smoking bones every day. That part was really fucking dark. There was also this pronounced sense of individual destiny-making. If you didn't already know it, now you really knew that you were going to have to do it on your own. What happened with Bush versus Gore in 2000 in combination with September 11th? I mean, if you believed in institutions, if you believed in the moral arc of the universe inevitably bending towards justice, those two events are cataclysmic. Now you knew that there were no systems or institutions in place that were going to make it okay for you. Your life was going to be something that you determined.
Andrew Van Weingarten. I was a week into my freshman year at college, and that's such an impressionable stage. I was a virgin, and I was meeting all these new people, and was just bright-eyed and wow. Then September 11th came, and I got so deeply freaked out, paranoid, and just knocked off of my foundation of what reality was, that it totally just fucked me up. John Heilman. The 9/11 thing is part of the globalization story, the story of interconnectedness, that America is more porous and more connected. We're porous and we're permeable, and we're more connected to and interwoven within a global culture that a lot of people here didn't understand very well, or understood only partially and had minimized. Even before people didn't like George W. Bush because of the invasion of Iraq, even before that, they decided they wanted to destroy us and kill us, and they were going to wreak havoc. And that came as a surprise to a lot of coddled white college kids. Vito Roccaforte. I don't know what it did to music, but afterward it just seemed like everybody partied really hard. Nick Mark. Tis Was wasn't that far away from the World Trade Center, and there was the smell of the fire in the air. But we were there that Saturday, and people came down. It wasn't that packed, maybe 60 or 70 people. But the following week, jammed. I think people just wanted to dance and forget the horror for a few hours. Rob Sheffield. If you were living downtown at the time, honestly, you really needed a reason to just get the fuck out of there. It was really, really, really good to have a place to stand around and be surrounded by strangers in the dark watching a band, rather than the crowds of people in the city to look at the ruins and smell the smoke, which is what it was like during the day. It was a time when every band that came to town would play a song by a New York band. They would do this little gesture of solidarity for the encore, and sometimes they would come and be visibly wigged out on stage. People were still wearing gas masks. We then folded them up in our pockets for the walk home. You could tell that really freaked out some of the bands. I remember Stephen Malkmus played the Roxy in late October, early November 2001. You know him. He's not very emotionally fallible. He said something like, "Here we are playing the West Side. The West Side is the side of broken dreams. From downtown to all the unwritten doctoral dissertations up at Columbia University. But that's about as Bono as I'm going to get today." Then he ended with Satellite of Love. The drummer was singing the Bowie part, and he was singing the Lou Reed part, and it was so fucking beautiful. Like a lot of boys, he could express his feelings only through Lou Reed simulation. Asif Ahmed. After 9/11 happened, everything kind of shut down mentally. There was no showboating. Everyone was really nice. Free bus rides. It was like the city of brotherly love, really. And everyone suffered together. Sam Fogarino. For a couple of months thereafter, there was a great sense of paranoia, and New York bonded together. It was like, oh man, I'd rather be in shitty New York with people pissing on my leg. Jesse Mallon. I thought September 11th would scare away all the posers, but it actually made everybody sympathetic. It was like, we've got problems, but we're all working on them. And then, culturally, I think because the music had so much of that special energy, somehow the energy of the city coincided with the music. The sound of the city was just kind of amplified. You felt like sound waves were coming from this specific place, and reaching far and wide. Tunde Erebimpe. After 9/11, we basically decided there's no reason for being here besides to make the things we like to make and share them or not share them. Because who's keeping score now? Try to find some kind of joy or meaning in your life. Because it's suddenly really fucked up outside. Dave and I just said, you know what we should do? Since the world might end, we should just stay inside and work. If we're going to die, we should probably just make a ton of shit that we like first. Dave Siddick. For better or for worse, TV on the radio was addressing that it happened. We just couldn't avoid talking about it. I was a lover before this war. I was thinking about getting laid. And now I'm thinking about dying in the fucking eternity. Tunde Erebimpe. You were convinced that any second, at the door, there's going to be some bad guys. And we'll be like, hey, listen, we don't believe in America either. Look at this minor threat record. Really, we're with you. And they'd shoot us anyway. That was how it felt after 9/11. And that was when we decided that we were going to keep making stuff. That was when we started working on the Young Liars EP. Sam Fogarino. I'd say for a minute we probably collectively thought that it was over. That we were not going to make a record. But then it became fuel for the fire. New York puffed up again and said, you picked the wrong city. You picked the wrong one. And on a microscopic level, this little band, Interpol, is going to put out a fucking record anyway. Ed Drost. That fall, I felt like no one really knew how to fully process what was happening. And as a result, everyone kind of went bonkers crazy. I don't know whether it was a result of the tragedy. I just remember that's when a lot of the craziest parties started. And that's when I moved to Brooklyn, and immediately was exposed to all this new stuff. Andrew Van Weingarten. It was the starting point of my friendship with Ben Goldwasser. We started hanging out and playing music together. It shocked us in a way that released some sort of desire to act out. Jesse Mallon. There was a lot of fear and a lot of nervous energy. And all that makes for sex and coke and good music. Vito Roccaforte. People were like, fuck it. It was wild. It got really fun. And it seemed like there was a lot more drugs everywhere all of a sudden.
Sarah Lewitton. Post 9/11 New York City had the energy that you were going to die anyway. Taking a subway, opening mail, walking down the street. So why die sober?
Moby. For the next 6 months, everyone I knew was suddenly like, this is the end of times. I'm already a drunk. Instead of going out 5 nights a week, I'm going to go out 7 nights a week. Instead of taking ecstasy 4 nights a week, I'm going to take ecstasy every night. Sarush Alvi. The bubble burst and the economy collapsed and 9/11 happened. And it went into this 5-year vortex of New York becoming a massive den of iniquity. So much booze and coke. It was a super promiscuous town. RZA. I feel like 9/11 froze our city. It definitely froze me. It numbed us. But at the same time, it numbed those who were successful. But those who were striving to come on, it inspired them. That's usually a paradox. You'll see one thing stop, and then something else grows. Angus Andrew. It was an incredibly horrible event, right? That's established. But it was also very inspirational. When something like that happens, on your doorstep, and you're there, it becomes the center of the world. And you feel like you're in the center of the world. That's inspiration in itself. It made you want to pick up your pen and write something down. Carl Swanson. Right before 9/11, it was July of 2001. I had my birthday at Campbell Apartment in Grand Central. Right next to it was this staircase. This was a Saturday night, so no one was around. And you know how they have those walkways? We walked across those walkways in Grand Central on the roof, and it was kind of the most amazing thing. It wasn't so much that the city was abandoned. It was that it was open and not secure. That you could get to the roof of Grand Central drunk on a Saturday night. That changed. It changed because of money. And it changed because of 9/11. And sometimes I think those things are connected. I don't really know how they are. But once this place was thoroughly secure, then it could also be thoroughly monetized. In a weird way, in retrospect, all the paranoid hippie stuff was right. Tunde Edibimpe. That guy in the suit? He was the canary in the fucking coal mine. I feel like New York was about to turn into what it is now way earlier. And then 9/11 paused it. Chapter 31. That now legendary Halloween stroke show at Hammerstein. Moby. Everyone who lived in Lower Manhattan expected New York to be done. It's going to go back to the way it used to be, but not in an interesting way. It's going to be dirty and scary and empty. But 9/11 focused the world's attention on New York, and in a weird way, it really boosted tourism. Suddenly more and more people were coming to New York and being surprised at how much they liked it. Jason Gordon. People wanted to look at New York. They wanted to celebrate New York. And the Strokes were at the center of that. Here was this true New York band. Ryan Gentles. Is This It finally came out in America that October. Jim Merlis. Then there was that now legendary Halloween stroke show at Hammerstein. Rob Sheffield. That Halloween show was the greatest. Gideon Yeago. They had never headlined a venue that large before in Manhattan.
Jenny Eliscu. I was with Gideon that night. He was wearing devil horns.
Gideon Yeago.
I was dressed like the devil that night. Although it's probably more appropriate to say I was dressed like a member of the Hive's faint, refused Interpol with horns, because my outfit was basically a black suit, black shirt, and red tie. It was always suits and ties at that point. Craig Finn. I was distracted by baseball. The Yankees were in the World Series, so I did the New York thing and only saw the headlining band, the Strokes. They didn't move. They didn't do anything. They were so cool.
Gideon Yeago.
This new style of mod was a counterpoint to the all red-hatted, dreadlocked, limp-biscuity bro bullshit that constituted mainstream rock and roll at that time. A dinner jacket at a bar was no less subtle a statement than a mohawk in 74, a nod to the sea change going on downtown, the self-identifier with the new tribe of sleaze that the Strokes were definitely the forefront of. It felt intimate, an in-joke. Not yet baked, calcified, or fully formed. Something you could still help define. Rob Sheffield. Albert's guitar teacher opened that show with his surf band.
Laura Young. The Papaya Kings.
Rob Sheffield. Everybody was hating that band. It was hilarious. There were these dancing bikini girls on stage, and they played this really funny song called Great Big Jerk. It was just about being a great big jerk. After that, it was the Moldy Peaches, who were so, so good. At that point, they were getting so much better from show to show that it was like seeing a different band every time. Adam Green. It was the biggest place we had ever played. I was so nervous. But it was Halloween, and we were the kind of band that was made for Halloween. I wore something pink, I think. I remember everyone in the Strokes switching their jackets like right before they went on. Rob Sheffield. Then the Strokes came out. Their entrance music was Jonathan Richman's The Morning of Our Lives. But just the end of it, where Jonathan sang, "We're young now, now's the time, to have faith in what we can do." The Strokes just played the final minute of the song as their entrance music. It was so unbelievably exciting. It was the kind of moment that made me grateful to be alive. Adam Green. A city smelled like barbecue. Rob Sheffield. This is 6 weeks after 9/11. and it was a lot of people's first time going out to a rock show since then. There was such a warmth to that night that you actually thought for a moment they might come back and play an encore.
Gideon Yeager.
Almost everyone was